On this episode of Still Loading...
Master Kibushi. Huh?
My pain. My suffering. Taste the torture that I endure!
Hello everyone and welcome to this next episode for the summer of PlayStation 2, to this new episode of the Still Loading Podcast. I am your host, Josh Koval, and with me today, I have Cade from the Gaming Memories Podcast. Cade, how are you doing today?
Really good. How are you, man?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you for agreeing to come on. The game we are talking about, a game, because I sent you a list, or no, sorry, I asked you for a list of games that you liked on the PlayStation 2, and you sent back to me a handful, and Shinobi kind of fit this section of the summer of PS2, because the episode before this is Dragon Ball, or sorry, the episode before this is Soul Calibur 2, and the episode after this, spoiler alert for everyone else, is God of War, so it kind of fits into that kind of a realm. But before we dive into Shinobi, what I've been asking everyone is, what is their earliest PlayStation 2 memory? How did you first come to experience the console, or when did you first get it? Things along those lines.
My first memory of hearing about it, I had a subscription to EGM and a bunch of other gaming magazines, because the PlayStation 1 is like my, it's my golden years. It's my first love.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very excited for the PlayStation 2 and was reading a lot about it. And the big thing then, I was probably, what year did it, do you know off the top of your head what year PS2 launched?
2000.
2000.
It was the 20th anniversary. It came out October, I want to say like 26th, because my last episode for the summer of PS2 is October, well, it goes into fall, but is October 25th. And I believe that was one day before the release. But anyway, go on.
Perfect. Okay. So yeah, I would have been 85 to 2000. I would have been 15 years old. Yeah, that sounds about right. And the big deal was it's going to have a DVD player built in. And DVDs were pretty new. And everyone I knew, people who weren't even into video games, were talking about like, well, maybe I'll just get a PS2 because it's a DVD player. Plus, if I ever want to play games. And I remember I don't remember which one was first, but there was two memories really close. A friend of mine, my dad's friend, had a PS2. For a DVD player, and I watched The Matrix on DVD on a PS2 for the first time. And I was I was by myself, and my dad, I think there was like some drama going on with, now that I'm an adult, I think there was some shit going down in the neighborhood, and they were like talking about some serious stuff, and they were like, I was with my dad, and he had to keep me entertained, and he knows I love video games. Do you have a PS2? I'm like, what? They have a PS2? See ya. You guys... And I was probably down there for hours because I had never had a DVD player before. I had never seen The Matrix. I had heard about The Matrix. So I watched The Matrix by myself on a PS2 at a neighbor's house. Was blown away for multiple reasons. And then I saw another neighbor. He had a launch, like early PS2. And he had, the first game I remember was like the original SSX, the snowboarding game.
Okay.
And that was and I didn't get it immediately because I was still into the PS1. It was really expensive. My parents were going to buy it for me. I didn't have the money to get it. But I remember going, one friend had it, and we played a lot of SSX. And that was, but I remember him saying there's not that many games. And I haven't done a research on the launch titles of PS2, but I got one not maybe like 6 months, but probably would have been the next year in the summer or maybe the next Christmas. It might have been a whole year later.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Dark Cloud was like the only RPG and I didn't like it. There was still like a lot of thin game. There wasn't a lot of games when I first got it, and I might have been a full year after it launched.
Okay. I don't know when Dark Cloud came out. I actually have it in my collection. I'd have to see. I actually tried that game somewhat recently. It's interesting. It wasn't what I was expecting. I didn't get far into it, but it's not like a typical JRPG that you would expect.
It was basically a launch title, December 14th, 2000. That makes sense.
Okay, wow.
Yeah, there was... The PS2 was amazing. The graphics on SSX blew my mind, and the fact that I could play DVDs, and the fact that I was exposed to The Matrix for the first time on a PS2, it's definitely special. Those memories are very clear to me this very day, because it was, I haven't had that feeling of getting my mind completely blown by video games at the same level like new generations of consoles did growing up.
Yeah.
It was very just like, my goodness, look at this game. Look at the snow. You can see this. The tracks are even better than 1080 snowboarding. I can see, you know, like just like going crazy because the snow looked realistic. It was good times.
It's so hard to impress us as adults now, because I don't even know if it's us just jaded. I know it's not even being jaded. We've just seen so much, you know, seen so much things now. So it's like when something big happens, it has to be legitimately like huge for it to really impress us. Yeah. I remember the last time I had that experience was trying to think. The last one I remember that literally just like melted my brain was when I first played World of Warcraft, and I was like, wait, this is an actual world. It's not just like, I'd never played a game where a world was that open at that point.
Yes.
Like it was,
yes.
It felt that real to me. And I mean, it's weird because that game came out in 2004, and you wouldn't really see true open world games to that level until, I don't know, maybe like Fallout 3-ish.
Yeah.
It just kind of like something like that. And there's probably others before that, but that's cool though, man. That's cool how that all started off for you. So we're going to talk about Shinobi. Shinobi came out in North America on October 10th, 2002, and surprisingly came out later in Japan on December 5th, 2002.
Whoa, I didn't know that. That's weird.
Right?
That's really
it was developed
weird.
By Overworks, which is a division of Sega, which is now called Sega AM Research and Development 1. And the development for it began in May of 2001 with about 50 people on the development team. So that's just some real quick just stats thrown at you about it. But what got you into Shinobi at first, and what made you choose this game to put on your list?
I liked ninjas a lot. I've always liked ninjas. Okay, since I was a kid. There was my first ninja love was Ninja Gaiden on the NES. I played a lot of that. And I was a little bit older. I got it retrospect. I didn't have an NES when it came out. And then there was like Mystical Ninja Goemon on Super Nintendo. There was a bunch of Shinobis on Genesis, and I liked all of them. I had played it. I just knew like the Shinobi series was ninjas. And I don't know if I don't think Devil May Cry had. When was the release date of Devil May Cry? Do you know off the top of your head?
That's funny, because that was the most recent episode of the podcast released at the time of us recording this. Let me see. I have my notebook, which you might be able to hear me flipping through in the background. Let me see here. I had, that's Metal Gear Solid notes. That's
Wait,
Wario
don't tell
Land
me. So my
notes.
memory
that's Dragon
is
Ball Z Budokai notes. I had 2001.
Yes, I was right. So my memory
October
was
16th,
that
2001 in North America and August 23rd, 2001 in Japan.
Okay. I was a little skeptical of my own memory, but I had remembered Devil May Cry coming out prior to Shinobi. And I liked Devil May Cry, but I didn't like Dante's character design that much. I thought like the red trench coat with the bare chest was kind of, and the silver hair was cheesy, like too anime for me, which a lot of people would probably get mad at me, but it didn't.
That's, oh my God, you have no idea. So literally that episode that just came out, you know, whatever, earlier this week, I guess. Or wait, no, it's coming out this Sunday, actually, now that I think about it, like in 2 days. So you'll hear it in 2 days from the time we're recording this, which is, you know, going to be a couple months before this is released. Or not a couple months, like a couple weeks. But it's just funny because my friend who I had on the show adores Dante's design. So it's so funny to me that like within like just right next to each other, the 2 days before the episode's coming out, I have you on shitting all over it. And then he literally like beats into my head that Dante's a cool guy. And that's what oh my God, it was so funny. That's really funny though. I didn't like Devil May Cry all that much, and not because I thought it was bad. It was because I was bad at it. That was why I didn't like it.
It was a very hard game. And I liked the lore. I liked the lore and the idea of Dante, which is what carried me through the game. I loved the lore and the idea. The gameplay was obviously tight, revolutionary, juggling people with the guns. All that stuff was awesome. But I just didn't... I just thought it was just a little too over-the-top anime. It wasn't my thing. But everything else I loved, so I put up with it. I had always thought ninjas were cool. I actually specifically remember thinking, I wish Dante was a ninja. It'd be cooler. Because he moves like a ninja. He, you know what I mean? He has, if he felt like a ninja, but he looked like a, like, I don't know, like your typical asshole frat boy. I don't know. It just didn't, it just didn't work for me. And I was aware of Shinobi as the series because I played again on Genesis and stuff. But my favorite ninja of all time, and I was already way into him, was Strider. And he was...
Okay.
I don't think Marvel versus Capcom 2 had come out yet, but I'm pretty sure Marvel versus Capcom release date had come out already. We'll see if I'm right. Yeah, that came out in 98. So Marvel versus Capcom, Strider's design, his sprite work, his animations... was like my favorite aesthetic, favorite ninja design of all time. I loved Strider because he was a mix of ninja and high tech. This all has context because when I saw a preview, or I actually just saw the box art for Shinobi at Blockbuster, I was like, wait, there's a new Shinobi? And he has like a high tech suit. We'll get into the aesthetic, but his design is, it's like he's almost got like a high tech sneaking suit on with kunai on his arms, and he has like a visor. And so immediately I'm like, oh shit, Shinobi went sci-fi. It went high-tech like Strider. And Strider was my favorite. I was just gushing over Strider all the time. I would play Strider all the time. Strider 2 on the PlayStation 1 is one of my favorite action games of all time. So I was primed. Okay. I was primed to be taken, like I just wanted more ninja shit. And so I saw Shinobi. I looked at the back. I'm like, oh my God, this is Devil May Cry, but ninjas! Everything I've ever wanted. I will say that I was slightly disappointed in the actual game overall, even as a kid, because it wasn't as dynamic. It's not as polished as Devil May Cry. It's not as good. But there are things I like about it better, and that's what caught my attention is a sci-fi ninja. You know, I knew Shinobi as a series, a new Shinobi game, sci-fi ninja. I was already in the Devil May Cry, another action game. I was ready.
Real kind of tangential to that, but since you're so into ninjas, did you watch the Three Ninjas movies when you were a kid?
Oh, did I?
Thank you. No one else knows about those movies.
Tum Tum for life, baby. Tum Tum for life.
I was a Rocky fan. I just because like Rocky was the oldest. I was the oldest kid. I was three brothers. I was the oldest. So I was like, well, I'm Rocky. I got to be Rocky.
Yeah, I get it. Tum Tum was like the Michelangelo equivalent of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yes, definitely. Colt was definitely the Raphael.
Yes,
they and didn't really Rocky have a. He was kind of like the Donnie. Not even. I
he was like Donnie
the
and
Leonardo.
Leo together.
Yes, that's so funny, dude. I unabashedly love those movies. I can look back on those now and know, like, they're not very good.
No,
like, there's a lot of problems with those movies, but I adore the shit out of them. Snyder from the first movie is one of my favorite over-the-top villains ever. I find him endlessly enjoyable, and I don't know why.
The cheese, there's a sometimes when there's something about there's something magical when the right amount of cheesiness is hit, like the perfect, like so bad it's good type of style. That's where Three Ninjas fit. I just did a recent video, didn't do very well on Instagram and TikTok. I'm probably not going to do it again because it took me forever. But I did a two-part series where I went through all my favorite ninjas in video games, like a short clip and a short explanation. And my number one video game ninja was Tum Tum from SNES Three Ninjas. It's kind of
Dude,
a joke.
That game's rare, too. If you can find a copy of the original Three Ninjas Kickback for the Super Nintendo, that is an expensive game to get.
I didn't know that. I just got on emulator, so, but yeah.
That's funny though. I like we'll go back to Shinobi, but you're just talking about how much you love ninjas. I'm like, I gotta ask this because this was like that was my childhood movie. I loved the Three Ninjas movies. I was baffled when they went to Three Ninjas Kick Back and two of the actors were just mysteriously different. And then and then you go to Three Ninjas Knuckle Up and all of a sudden the same actors are back again. And then they get completely different ones for High Noon at Mega Mountain, and Hulk Hogan and Jim Varney are in it, of all people. Like, it's such a weird series of films. And, like, none of the actors look the same in that movie. They're all different. Every single one. Yes. I think the parents are the same. I think that's the only through line through the whole series is the parents are the same.
You are definitely the first person to ever bring it up. So it's not – yeah, it's weird how – I would assume it'd be a bigger part of more, you know, men our age. I would assume it would be a bigger part of their childhood. But I've brought it up a couple times, and I thought that like that video would do really well because I said that Tum Tum was the greatest video game ninja, and I was like, be capitalizing into this. Dude, no one gave a shit. No one even knew. Like, nobody, they were like, all the comments were like, who's Tum Tum? Like, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? Who's Tum Tum?
Have you never watched Three Ninjas? Like, come
exactly.
on, man. Oh my god! And those movies are just so—they're bad. They are so bad, but I love them so much. I quote my favorite Snyder line is when they're on the ship, right? And the kids escape again. The kids escape from Snyder, and the Mr. Brown or whatever calls Snyder, and he's like, "Oh, you know, he's such a nervous dude," and he's calling Snyder, let him know the kids have escaped. And Snyder's reaction is just, "Kids, I want them found now, or I'll tear out your liver." And just his delivery was as stale as the way I delivered it right there. It was just not good. Oh, it's
I need to
so
go back
funny.
And I haven't rewatched him since I was a kid. I wonder if the nostalgia glasses, I wonder how I would feel about it.
I still enjoy them, but it's definitely more of an ironic enjoyment because there's let me put it this way. If, my wife and I were expecting, so we are going to have a kid soon. And if my kid watched a movie like this, sorry, what did you say?
I said congratulations.
Oh, thank you. If my kid watched a movie like this, I don't think I'd enjoy it. I like it because I grew up with it. I don't think I could stomach a new movie that was like this. But that's just how I remember it. So if you do ever watch it again, you can't really find it on like streaming services now that I think about it. You know, I'm going to look that up while we're talking. But anyway, so we should get into Shinobi.
Yeah.
We've been spending a lot of time on Three Ninjas. Dude, we're going to have to do an episode of something. I don't if it's one of our podcasts about Three Ninjas or just ninja movies.
I would be 100% down for a ninja movie podcast. 100%.
Okay. Right? Oh, God, it'd be so fun. I'll talk to you off mic because I have some ideas maybe I want to float by you. But, okay, so Shinobi, let's dive into it then. So the game is it's an action-adventure, more of an action game, I would say, more than adventure. It's an action game. And what I thought was cool about it just from the gameplay that I watched. Now, full disclosure, I did not play this game. I didn't get a chance to try out and see how the controls feel. I couldn't find a copy of it for the original hardware. I actually went to my local game store, masked up, hand sanitizered up, went to the local game store, see if they had a copy of it, and they didn't. I was really bummed out by that. So that was kind of a bummer, but I did watch some videos of it, and the gameplay seems interesting because it seems like targeting based. Like you have to target individual enemies and then slash them, and you can kind of freeze their dying animation, and you can attack a bunch of enemies and up to a certain point, and then they all kind of die at the same time.
Yes, that's
Am
probably
right
my.
With that?
You are right. That's one of the things I like most about the game. I still like it today. I've been playing it all week in preparation for this podcast, and one of the things I remember playing it originally as a kid, as a 15-year-old, was I don't know what the word is, and you might know there's a word for that. It's in all sorts of Japanese animation, it's in all sorts of Japanese movies and cartoons where like the death of someone is delayed until the samurai or ninja puts their sword in the sheath, and then the person falls apart behind him and blood splurts everywhere. There's that motif.
I don't know what the term is. I know what you're talking about, yes. But I don't know what the term for that specific type of motif would be.
there probably is a term for it, but like it's just that style that definitely, especially as a kid, you only got that from Eastern, from animes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was what it is each time you find a new... So the gameplay is pretty stale in the sense of it's like hallway, square platform, hallway platforming, square platforms. And on the square platforms, you fight enemies. And I'm sure it was a technical limitation for development on the PS2, but there's never more than like five or four enemies at a time in a group.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be these like little kanji, like there'll be red orbs in the top right hand of the screen, which indicates how many enemies are you're currently fighting. And if you kill all of...
Oh, that's what that is.
That's what that is. That's how many enemies there are.
Because there was no information given on the screen, so I was just kind of like, I don't understand how they're doing this. That makes a lot more sense. That's cool. But, okay, go on.
And then, so if you kill... Now, they won't freeze forever. If you kill an enemy, they'll freeze, like, stuck before they split apart and spew blood everywhere. And if you kill all of them I don't know what the time frame is, and it might be dynamic based on the enemies that you're fighting, but it seems to be like 15, 30 seconds. If you kill all that group, then you'll get like a mini cutscene where the camera will zoom and Shinobi will like say some sort of line like, you know, your suffering is over or rest in peace. And he'll put his sword in his sheath. Then they will all split apart at the same time and blood will spew everywhere. And I think you get
That's
more
kind of
points.
Dope.
Yeah, it's super. It's one of my, and as a kid, that wasn't as cliche or that wasn't a motif that I knew I was aware of it, but it was like, to me, it was dripping with style. And that's one of the things I loved about it. Yeah. But if you take too long to kill the whole group, you won't get that little cutscene. They'll end up splitting apart on themselves.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. And there, I did notice that the way the game was kind of sectioned off is that the levels were sectioned off. Like you would have a small area of the map and you could kind of explore that area a little bit. It wasn't large by any stretch of the imagination,
No.
But you could like jump up on top of buildings and dash across. The dash mechanic was super fun because it would leave like a blue shadow of where Shinobi was, and it would kind of trail off like you're freaking Marty McFly in Back to the Future or something like that. And, No, that wasn't a good example, but you get the idea. I just thought that was a really cool mechanic. So you would defeat all the enemies in an area or a certain amount of enemies in an area, and then you could move on to the next one. I did notice that as I watched some of the areas, like the quote-unquote victory, I guess the victory condition for that area, or like the progress condition for that area, was different. Like I watched the whoever was playing it just run through a bunch of enemies and just go over to the next area, and they didn't have to kill anybody. So I don't know what all the objectives are. Are there different objectives besides just killing all the enemies on screen?
Gameplay wise, yes, the objectives, they are, I learned that like the second time around. I was probably on like level 3. As far as I know, you don't have to kill the enemies. You can
really,
you can skip past them, and there's like these stone blocks. So every area will have like a force field with like the main bad guys we'll get to in the story. He has like this emblem, and there'll be like a force field where you can't go past a certain area. Well, there's these like floating stones in a lot of sections. If you kill the stones, if you break the stones, the force field will drop and you can skip the enemies. But that comes at the cost of, once you, like, you're like halfway through stage 2, like the demon sword awakens and you have to keep killing enemies to keep it satiated. And if you don't satiate it, it will kill you. So it's this balance of, you can skip enemies, but if you skip too many, your sword will possess you because you need to kill them.
That's actually kind of cool.
Yes, it's very cool.
That's a good story mechanic for it. Are there any unique bosses that you can remember from what you were able to play of it? Or because I know, like you said, you played it a lot when you were a kid, and you played a good amount of it. You weren't able to finish it, but you played a good amount of it in preparation for this episode. Are there any interesting bosses that you can think of?
Yes, the first time you fight your brother at the end of stage 1 is the first time the lock-on mechanic, like, you have to use. Because and you have that dash move is more than just style. Like, they use it a lot for double jumping and platforming in platforming sections to get to this platform to the next. But when you're locked on, you can push away or forward or back, left or right, and he will dash around the person you're locked on and attack them from behind. And that becomes basically all the boss fights. I beat it as a kid. I remember beating it as a kid, and I can vaguely remember the second half of the boss fights. I just played through the first half, a few bosses. All of them so far, the ones that I played this week that I know for sure, is that becomes a core, like the boss fights are a completely different style of gameplay. You're not managing a group, you're locked on, and you're dashing and dodging moves and waiting for the right opening where the boss, you can actually hurt them, and then they attack you back and you dodge around, and the whole point is to flank them. So in that part, I think that gameplay, the boss mechanic, the boss fights are much better and much tighter than the average enemies you fight during a level.
Like okay.
Mainly because of the camera, which is the absolute biggest gripe I have is the camera is dog shit. I mean, dog shit. Like, first off, it's I know back in the day, 3D games, like, the controls weren't as standardized as they are now.
Yeah.
So the right stick, the camera is inverted, what I consider inverted, meaning when I turn right, when I push right, the camera views left. When I push left, the camera views
right.
I'm
the same way. I don't like that. I understand from a conceptual point, because if the camera is behind you and you move the camera to the right, it's going to look left because of the way it is. And if you move the camera to the left, it's going to look right. Yes. So they're taking a very literal interpretation of how the camera operates, because it literally says you are moving the camera, not you are moving where you're looking, if that makes sense.
And most modern games, like I've been playing Ghost of Tsushima a lot, and like most
another
modern
ninja game, well,
in a kind
samurai.
Of yeah, samurai. There's ninja aspects to it, and just modern games in general, the default setting is inverted from that. So my muscle memory going back and playing that game this week, part of my hatred for the camera is that the right stick is inverted and there's no option to change it.
They didn't have old games, especially old 3D games, because they were coming off controls that really didn't need to be modified all that much, to now you have these 3D worlds and now all of a sudden like, oh, maybe we should make this more accessible to more people because there's a lot of stuff going on.
Yes. So that frustrates me. But the other thing is the game, I didn't realize until probably second day of playing it this week, and I don't know if you saw some of the stuff in development when you did research, the game was developed for speedrunning. For everything's a time attack. It's really a time attack game. And
really?
Once that clicked, it became way more fun because the camera, it doesn't move freely. It moves in like steps. Like if you hit right,
okay,
it won't just kind of glide right. It will move to a certain degrees to the right. And then it'll lock.
Like a locked position.
It'll
like
locked position
in the right.
So it's like you have a series of points in 3D around the character that the camera can move to. And the wall running mechanic, there's a wall running mechanic, but there's really only three levels. When you attach to the wall, you can run straight. And if you jump a little bit, you'll attach to the bottom of the wall. If you jump a medium, you'll attach to the medium of the wall. And everything's built around running. Everything's like lanes. Like you have three ticks on your right camera, three ticks on your left, three ticks up and down, you're three in the wall. And so really it's like you're trying to find the right path to kill everything and run through and go as fast as you can. And that's why the game feels so boxy. The whole entire game is boxes in straight hallways. And when I was a kid, I thought it was boring because Devil May Cry had these like awesome environments, an awesome castle. The castle and the lore was as much a part of the game as the actual action was. Whereas Shinobi is I didn't realize it as a kid, but now playing it this week, oh, this is a time attack game. And that's why everything's so straight, because you're supposed to memorize, like, oh, these enemies, they're on the left lane on this platform. So I got to run in the middle lane, slash these two. Then I got a wall run here, but I got a wall run on the bottom lane because of this enemy. And once you figure that all out, you can fly through a level really fast. Because I kept beating levels without getting hurt, and I'd be like, rank D. I'm like, why? Why is my rank so low? I didn't even die once. It's because of my time. My time took too long.
Oh, okay.
The game wants you to figure out how to like get through the level and be a ninja. And then I watched some speedrunning videos online or some videos online. I'm like, oh, that's how it was designed to be played. It wasn't designed to play like Devil May Cry necessarily.
That's really interesting. I didn't even think about it that way, because the guy I was watching playing it, the person I was watching playing it, they sped through it. Like, they were just burning through enemies so fast, and part of me was like, come on, no, take your time. Like, I want to be able to kind of absorb more of this in and kind of get to understand what this game is like, because I didn't have the ability to play it, unfortunately. But that makes a lot more sense why that person sped through, because like you said, it's more of a time attack game. The faster you do it, the better rank you're going to get. Some quick notes, just some stuff that I looked up. The game was originally planned to be released for the Dreamcast, actually, before the Dreamcast died, which makes sense because this came out in 2002. The Dreamcast pretty much died in North America in late 2000, and game development cycles are generally, you know, 2 to 3 years, especially back then, and even more so now. It was the first 3D game in the series. And as we've seen and as we've talked about, a lot of the game's game mechanics are based around sword combat. Well, the 2D Shinobi games are more shuriken based. You would throw your shuriken at enemies and you kind of attack from a distance. But since that's kind of difficult to do in 3D and make it fun, especially back then when they didn't have quite as refined mechanical ideas, I guess, for lack of a better term, like, a lot of them were kind of what Linked, or not Linked the Past, I'm sorry, Ocarina of Time did, where you'd have Z targeting to kind of do that. So that way you could.
This has that too, by the way. You have a camera reset button, which I think was their way. Like, the camera is so unintuitive. And even if the right stick was inverted, it still controls really weird. But L1, like Zelda, if you press L1, it's camera reset.
Okay.
And that's basically how I ended up this last week. I can't get the camera to feel good. I even messed with my emulator control settings and my dead zones trying to get it to, like, feel better, and I couldn't get it. But if you just use that camera reset like Zelda, just hit that Z button, the camera sinks behind the player, and I just got really good. You press the camera reset every 10 seconds, every 5 seconds. Then it's playable at that point.
So it's interesting because it's not great camera controls, but once you understand how the game wants you to operate the camera, then the game becomes much more fun and much more playable, even if the camera controls aren't the most user-friendly. The last little bit of info I had on it was that, and we've kind of talked about it a little bit with how much of this game is focused on action, and there's a little bit of exploration elements, but for the most part, it's just straight action. And producer Takashi Urui wanted the game to focus on action, but also have some adventure elements. And he mentioned specifically that a lot of AAA or a lot of action and adventure games, it's like, if you're doing on a scale of like 1 to 10, it's like an 8 for adventure and a 2 on action. Well, for Shinobi, he wanted it to be a 6 on action and a 4 on adventure to kind of balance in terms of balancing it like that. So, and to be honest, that's from what I saw, that's pretty much what it is. It is much more action focused. And yeah, you can jump around from rooftop to rooftop and do some cool wall running stuff. But for the most part, it is a very linear action game. And that's not a bad thing. I was thinking about this when I was prepping for this episode. This game looks like a PlayStation 2 game, and I don't mean that in a mean way. I mean, like, if you look at generic PS2 game, like, that you would see in the background of some TV show or some movie, this would be that game.
Yes. Yes.
Would you agree with that?
I would agree. Yes. It's very, in some aspects, the action is more refined, and even though it came out after Devil May Cry, what I felt today, I played it again right up until this podcast, just so I have that feeling fresh. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's an aged game that once you learn how it was designed to be played, it's a little bit better. But it's a PS2 game, not just in looks, but in functionality. It feels like a PS2 game, and you don't realize how far we've come with controls and cameras and feelings and action and, like, assisted targeting and stickiness and melee combat, how melee combat feels. Like, if it is a PS2 game through and through, like, not just aesthetically, but mechanically, technically, it is a PS2 game.
Yeah. And I kind of love that about it, though, because it's so there's different level. There's, you know, there's different timelines of nostalgia. And your whole podcast is all about gaming nostalgia, you know, everyone going through their memories and just kind of reminiscing about it. And when I looked at this game, it just made me so happy to look at because it reminded me, even though I didn't play this as a kid, it looked like the PlayStation 2 in all the best ways. I know it's dated in the best ways too, in a weird way, just because it's, I was thinking about this. I feel like every console generation has a genre of games that really define it and really kind of go for it. And I would say like PlayStation 2 for the beginning, it was 3D platformers, but I would say what really defined it was the action adventure genre. Cause you had, you know, Devil May Cry, you had this, you had God of War, you had, I mean, even like the Jak and Daxter games, those are platformers, but they're kind of action adventure at the same time. Ratchet and Clank is an action platformer. It was more of an action game genre.
Yes.
And those were the most popular ones on the consoles. And there were still some popular shooters. But for the most part, like Call of Duty wasn't big on the PS2. You had the first Killzone, and that was a late entry into the console's life cycle. And I'm not saying, you know, all the games obviously were that. There's, you know, plenty of popular games that were not in this action genre. But, I mean, there's just so many games on it. That are kind of like this, I don't know, in my mind, that defines the PS2. As we get to PS3 and 360, it was the first-person shooter. You know, that was the console of, those were the consoles that Call of Duty reigned supreme on. And you had people trying to copy Call of Duty. And then I would say this most recent generation is the open-world RPG, you know, Horizon Zero Dawn. To an extent, Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, even though that was on the Switch, but, you know, Horizon Zero Dawn, Ghost of Tsushima just came out. And then also, I'm trying to think, I'm looking at my PS4 library right now, and I'm trying to think of some others.
Well, even Halo Infinite's going open world. Open world's in right now. Yeah.
And I mean, that was like the big thing. That was what, I mean, because Sony won this past console war by a long shot. So a lot of their most popular games were these big open world RPGs, and Assassin's Creed, what that turned into. It was already kind of open world, but it kind of went more open world. And, you know, Red Dead Redemption, just open world in general, whether it's an open world RPG or open world sim or something like that. But we're kind of off track. That's more of a, I don't know, that's just a theory I've been working on lately. I don't know if that's actually very sound. I'd have to actually do some research to be like, well, what were the most popular games for this generation and this generation?
My gut tells me, I think you're maybe, like, if you looked at like a database list of every game released on the PS2 and genre, maybe action adventure wouldn't be, like, there wouldn't be a higher percentage of raw games released in that genre because the PS2 has so many games. But my guess is you're right when you look at the top like 500 or top 300, 200 best-selling games on the PS2
would be those action games.
Most of them would be the action,
Because like the top-selling ones are not action games. Gran Turismo like destroys so many numbers. It's wild. Let me actually look this up now that I'm curious about it. I don't want to go too far into it because it would be top-selling games. I want to use that for my PS2 retrospective to end the summer of PS2. But the list of best-selling PS2 games, actually, Grand Theft Auto San Andreas was the number one selling, 17.33 million copies. That is insane. Yeah, even at number seven, Metal Gear Solid 2, Sons of Liberty, that's stealth, but that's still an action, stealth action. There we go. Grand Theft Auto, action-adventure.
God of War is 14, God of War 2 is 16. Jak and Daxter.
Wow, an iToy is on here. Ratchet and Clank is 21. I don't know. For some reason in my head, that's what I see it as. I don't think it's that's how I characterize it. I don't think that's necessarily 100% accurate, but for some reason in my head, when I think of the PlayStation 2, like what really screams PlayStation 2 to me is action adventure games.
I could see that. It's I mean, I thought you were 100% right, because I have that same feeling, but now I'm reading the top selling games. It doesn't seem to be, but it might just have been like maybe in the top 20, there's a lot of other games, but we were into gaming. So maybe what got through to us, because as I'm scrolling down past like 75 to 100, I'm seeing a ton of action games. So I think maybe the density of like moderately, like only all the Onimushas on here, Resident Evils are on here. That's like survival horror, but it's action. Ghost Recon. Yeah, it's, I think, man, I don't know.
This might be a good episode topic for the future. Like have a panel of people on and do what genre won that console generation. What was the genre that you think was the most popular of that generation?
Or at least what you experienced. So you could, and then you could also pull, you could pull all games and sort by genre and see what genre just had the most games created for it. And then you could also weight that or filter that by like top 100, 200, 300 selling games and like what genre actually sold the most. Mm-hmm. I think looking at this list, depending on how you define action, because you have Dynasty Wars, Lord of the Rings, Lego, Devil May Cry 3, 2, 1, SOCOM, Spider-Man. I wonder if you took this Wikipedia list and then combined the total copies sold for all games that you would consider action, compare that towards racing, maybe combined that would be more than the juggernaut of Gran Turismo. And maybe that's why you have this sense of action games dominated the PS2.
I think it's also because I wasn't allowed to play Grand Theft Auto, though. I was allowed to play Gran Turismo, but I wasn't allowed to play Grand Theft Auto. So I feel like that's probably very much coloring my view of the PlayStation 2. I don't even know how we got on that. But, oh, no, I was talking about how Shinobi just looks like a PlayStation 2 game in all the best sensibilities. Let's kind of dive into the story for it, though. The story is pretty simplistic, but not actually in a bad way. A lot of times when I think of a simplistic story, I think of just like Mario, you know, someone gets captured. Well, Princess Peach gets captured. Mario goes to rescue her. And in this, the story is a little bit more in depth, but it's still pretty simple overall. You play as...
Yeah, good luck with these names.
Yeah, I know, right? You play as a character named Hatsuma, and he is the Shinobi. He is Shinobi. And I guess before we talk about the story, let's just talk about his design, because I think he looks badass still. 100%. I still think he looks cool.
100%. I mean, that's what I said stuck out to me when I saw Shinobi at Blockbuster and looked at the back. I mean, back in the day, there was no YouTube. You had to look at the back of the cover. He had a couple screenshots. And I just remember staring at that cover and being like, he is gangster as shit. I love everything about him. He looks awesome because, again, he's a mix of like high tech and ninja. It's like a little bit of sci-fi, like 3 out of 10 sci-fi, 7 out of 10 ninja.
Yes, I would agree with that. Yeah, he's got those cool, like, it almost looks like he has three eyes because he's got that like weird metal bandana type of thing that has like two eyes on it, and then it's his actual eyes underneath it. And as stupid as a design as that is, that's also kind of awesome looking to me, and I don't know why. I just think it looks nice. So I really like the design of that. And actually, the cover of it makes it almost look like it's like a face visor, like a face mask. But like when you're playing the game, he doesn't act. Does he ever bring it down? Like pull it down?
No,
the visor.
No, he doesn't.
So the cover of the game looks fucking dope as shit, but like in the game, he doesn't actually use those to look through. It's just up on his forehead, which I thought, or like kind of covering his eyebrows almost. Yes. Like it's
basically his eyebrows. Height. Yeah. I was going to say he has like a, it's like the material on his suit. It's like, it's not cloth. Like the way it looks like some sort of, it reminds me of Snake's sneaking suit in Metal Gear Solid 1. Or two, really. Yeah, yeah. It has like this kind of like carbon fiber flexible, almost like maybe light body armor. And then he has the back piece, the chest and back piece that's like heavier armored. And then he has these gauntlets that are like, that have shurikens attached on like the inside of his forearm that you throw, which they don't really work that, they're not a big part of a game. They're kind of useful to stun enemies. And then the biggest thing for me is when you actually play the game, his cape physics. Cloth physics weren't really a thing at the time. And I spent probably when I first got it, like the first two or three hours just running around like, oh my God, I've never seen cloth in a video game move and wave. And that to me was mind blowing. And now it's not that big of a deal. Like it's pretty standard, ninjas and cloth and headbands. But at the time that was, at least for me, I don't know, we could do some research. But I cannot think of a single game prior to Shinobi that had like cloth physics like that. I can't think of one.
I'm sure there might have been one, but I agree with you because it stood out to me. Like when I was watching the video of it, I was like, oh, that like cape of his move, like it flows in the wind.
Yes.
It flows with his movement. It looked really cool. And I was really impressed by how it looked, especially for an early PS2 game. We're not talking late gen. Late gen is when all the crazy stuff comes out. Like that's why, I mean, I've talked about this before, but if you look at like The Last of Us on PS3, it doesn't look that much worse than what this generation looks like now. I mean, it definitely doesn't look as good as what we have now, but it doesn't look that far off. It is the distance between Last of Us and this generation is nowhere near as big as the distance between PS1 and PS2 or PS2 and PS3. You know,
correct.
Like,
I agree.
It's a minimal thing, but like so late gen is always where the most innovations generally are on a console because developers have had years to figure out how to extract every bit of power out of the console. And the fact that this is an early PS2 title and it's got some really cool physics in it is pretty awesome.
I wonder if that's why, I mean, I mentioned before the game, it dawned on me that the game was designed around a time attack sort of methodology. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, explained why the environments were so square. Everything's square. Everything's a hallway and a square block. It's like the whole game, there's nothing other than square hallways and square platforms to fight on. And at the time you had Devil May Cry, it had already come out, right? So we knew it was possible. And I'm wondering if the cost of having those cape physics was so high that it limited them. I mean, I don't think that's really, because obviously time attack is a big part of the game. And so, but maybe that's part of it because I've been Googling while you were talking your last little section of talking. I can't find anything with cloth physics. Like definitely with PS1, yeah. There's nothing. Cloth has never been simulated on the PS1 very well. I'm trying to find something on PS2.
I don't think it would. Usually like very stiff, like it's non-moving. It's like this looks like a bandana, but it's just kind of sticks straight out, like it just got spiked into their neck or something.
I found a Reddit thread on a game development forum. Someone asking how did they pull off cloth physics in Shinobi on PS2?
Oh,
so we are not the first ones to bring this up.
How much is there? Like, how much would it take to sift through that? Like, if you want to read through it, I was going to just kind of go through the story real quick. If you want to read through it,
yeah, go through the story, and I'll see if I can find something of interest.
And I'll try to summarize it down as much as I can. But pretty much, you play as a character named Hatsuma, and in the beginning of the game, you see Hatsuma fighting what you find out later is his brother Moritsune. To the death, and you don't really know why, but until at the end you see that Hatsuma has to kill his brother, and his brother kind of takes it complacently, and you kind of find out that the reason is that they are part of this clan of ninjas called the Oboro clan, and the leader of the clan is decided by the two heirs doing a match to the death, a duel to the death, and it turns out the two heirs are these two brothers. So the winner of it got this sword, and you find out later it's this evil sword named Akujiki, and it's an evil soul-stealing sword, and he has to kill him with that. And so what ends up happening is that you find out that this sword steals souls. It has to live off of souls, but you don't really find that out until later on in the game. So 4 years later, there's a massive earthquake that strikes Tokyo, and a mysterious golden palace appears in it, in the center of the destroyed city. And a bunch of zombies of the Oboro clan start showing up out of nowhere, and you find out the villain of the game, which is...
He's got like Haka. His name starts with an H, isn't it?
Hiruko, yeah.
Yeah.
The villain of the game, Hiruko, is the one who, you know, did all this. He killed pretty much everyone in the Oboro clan except for Hatsuma. And Hatsuma has to fight through waves of people who used to be part of his clan, ninjas who used to be part of his clan, to get to Hiruko. And along the way, he meets someone who used to be part of his clan, Ageha. I don't know if I'm butchering these names. This is awful, so I apologize in advance. And you pretty much have to fight your way through, and you find out through this adventure, trying to get to Hiruko, to kill Hiruko, to rid the world of this evil, is that the sword, that Akujiki, that you were given by killing your brother, the reason why you had to kill your brother in the first place is that the soul of the Oboro clan, that the clan member that you had to kill, it sated the sword's bloodlust, its soul lust. And at some point in the story, the sword gets awakened, so you have to kill enemies, like you mentioned before, in order to continue to satiate it, so that way it wouldn't eat you. And so you fight through it, and you find out that this was all kind of part of his plan. There is basically what Hiruko's plan was, to have you come awaken this other evil creature named Yatsurao, and awaken that so you could kill it, and then he would kill you and gain the power of the sword.
Yes.
Yes. You end up killing him, but because you're so pissed off about everything, you want to kill him and destroy the sword, because the sword has caused nothing but trouble for everyone, which I think was a cool story choice. Like the sword, a lot of times you would, like, the hero might try to keep the sword, but it seems like he willingly kills himself at the end of the game, because the Golden Palace collapses at the end of the game on top of you. And I guess in the hopes that you're burying the sword forever. Yes. I don't really know. I didn't get to watch the end cutscene. I paraphrase that. There are some specifics that I left out, so definitely worth going to check out, because there's some other cool story elements that I didn't mention. But that I paraphrased that to Hell and Back. I surprisingly, even with a lot of ums and ahs and kind of some circle logic trying to explain all that, I'm actually pretty happy with how I did with that, because I'm normally not too great with it without having to read off a script.
I liked the concept. Even as a kid, I remember vaguely some of the things I felt about the story, and then playing through most of the game this last week, the idea of you have this demonic sword that's kind of the real enemy, like the real bad guy. I mean, Haku, whatever his name is, I can't pronounce the Japanese names, but the sorcerer, that's the bad guy, the end boss. He's like the mastermind behind it, but the only reason he even has this whole masterminded plan in the first place is because the sword exists, right? You have this sword that eats the souls of people. That's almost the real antagonist. And like we mentioned before,
right.
it's the whole thing revolves around the sword and you being manipulated to kill a bunch of demons to fill that sword full of souls. So the end boss can take. So you, basically, you do the work of powering up this sword for somebody else, and then his plan, the end boss's plan, the sorcerer's plan, is to get you to do all the work to power up this sword, and he's just going to take it from you, and then use the sword for himself. And that at the end, that's the vibe I got. I have one vague memory of beating it, being confused, thinking the same thing. Did he die in the collapse?
I mean, I don't know if, you know what, I don't think there's really been, has there been any other games in the
Nightshade
Shinobi series since
yes.
then? I'm going to look, I have it open right now.
I never played
2002 game, there was a sequel to the game called Nightshade, which was
yes.
based around one of the characters in it. And then there is Shinobi 3D for the 3DS, which looks like it's just a, I can't tell if it's just a re-release or if it's... No, it's a completely different game, but it's Shinobi 3D for the 3DS, which I have not played. The reception was mixed to positive reviews. Like, the aggregate score, according to Wikipedia on Metacritic, is a very nice 69. So it's got some mixed reviews overall about it, but it seems like after this game, there really wasn't much to it. And Nightshade, let's see if it has anything. It's the exploits of a female ninja named Hibana, and it's a sequel to the 2002 game Shinobi. And does it... I don't know if it really has anything. The story that it says on Wikipedia is that in Nightshade, the player plays as Hibana, a female counterpart to Shinobi's Hatsuma. She is a government-employed ninja tasked... A government-employed ninja. That's a sentence I never thought I would ever read. She is a government-employed ninja... She is a government employed ninja tasked with the elimination of members of the Nakatomi Corporation. Holy shit, diehards involved with this. the Nakatomi Corporation, which has unwittingly unleashed Hellspawn upon futuristic Tokyo. She is also ordered to recover the shards of Akujiki, the legendary curse sword that Hatsuma used to seal the Hellspawn the last time. There we go.
There it is. That makes sense. I remember seeing Nightshade at Blockbuster or whatever the other Hollywood Video, but I never played it. Mainly because as a kid, I was ultimately disappointed by Shinobi because it wasn't as cool as Devil May Cry. Even though I liked Shinobi as a character, I liked ninjas more. I never played Nightshade, but that makes more sense. She's recovering the pieces of the sword to put it back. Maybe got broken into pieces during the collapse of the Golden Palace or whatever.
Yeah. That I could see that. I mean, that and actually the cover is pretty cool. I think the name Nightshade's awesome as well. I think that's a cool name for a game, and just I don't know, it just maybe it's not as cool now, but I still think that sounds cool. The cover isn't quite as cool as
the Shinobi cover,
Shinobi
yeah.
one, but like looking at it, it looks like every 2000s movie poster. It's got like this big prominent figure up at the front, and then it's got someone kind of faded in the background, looking off in the distance. It's it's very 2000s in a good way too. And that's pretty much like just the overview of the story. I wanted to try to focus less on it, like instead of going beat by beat, because I realize I have a tendency to do that in these. And sometimes it's fun, but depending on the game, that can be very confusing. So it can be hard to summarize it really well. So I'm going to try to, going forward, I mean, a bunch of these have already been recorded. So in fact, after this episode comes out, I already have 4 more episodes already pre-recorded, so who knows how well I do it later on. But in any case, I actually think the story in this is kind of cool. Like you were saying, how the whole purpose is that the sword is pretty much the antagonist that you don't really know about until the very end of the game. Yep. I think it's a really fun story design. Even the sword itself is a character, and they didn't have to do... One of the things I hate is when... Like an inanimate object, they use an inanimate object as a villain, and it talks to you in like a demonic voice, like the sword is talking to you, or something's talking to you. And I don't mind that, but that's so cheesy, and it doesn't always work that well. So I like the fact that it doesn't seem like the sword really talks to you at all throughout the game. You just kind of, it just gives off like an evil vibe the entire time.
It just does what it does. Like, it doesn't need to talk to you. It's just, hey, if you don't satiate me, I'm going to eat your soul. So deal with that.
Just deal with it. In terms of visuals, we talked about Shinobi's visuals. I like the visuals of this overall. I thought the game looks really good for an early PS2 game. I thought the animation, specifically the cinematic animations were super fun and super like just that it was smooth. It looked nice. And you were playing on an emulator, which up-resed everything and made everything look super fancy. But even on this video that I was watching, it looked pretty good still.
Yeah, on I love, one of my favorite things is to play old games on emulators with, in modern resolutions with modern anti-aliasing, and sometimes depending on the game and depending on the emulator, you can have hacks that improve lighting and stuff, and it really brings out the assets in the game. It still looks, I mean, it looks awesome. Even mm-hmm. even now, like, it's, I mean, yes, I was playing on emulator in a modern resolution, but it still holds up. Aesthetics, I think some of the enemy designs overall are not that inspiring, but Shinobi himself is so cool. It's something I think Ghost of Tsushima, which is kind of similar. Let me rephrase this. If you're playing a third-person action game, mm-hmm. you need to never get sick of looking at your character, because you're going to be they have to be so cool that they're cool for 30 hours. And I think Shinobi does that. I think in that sense, the game is successful.
You're 100% right. There is something to be said, and not even just for character design, but even games like old 2D games where the soundtracks were so limited. If you're playing like a Mega Man level, the song that you're playing over and over and over again as you're dying a bunch of times trying to beat a level can't bother you to the point where that song would make you want to quit. I mean, don't get me wrong, you might still get frustrated hearing it, but it's not like it's a bad song. And I think there's something to be said about learning how to design something that can overstay its welcome, that can survive you have being frustrated with it. And there's a reason why first-person shooters in general are shorter games, because the gameplay mechanics are more restrictive than others, because you can only do so much in a first-person shooter without adding extra abilities into it. If you're just talking a straight military first-person shooter, campaigns are only like 5 hours, because how many different ways can you shoot a person? You know what I mean? Like, there's not that much, you know. It just, there's not that much to take from that. But like, and that's why you see now first person shooters that kind of innovate with that. That's why you get games like BioShock, or you get games like, I'm trying to think of another good example that does stuff like that. The Fear games, where they add a horror element into it.
Yes.
It's a shooter, but there's like horror elements into it and stuff like that. It's just, it's interesting. And you're right. I think Shinobi's design is really fun. I think the world just looks nice. It's very simple. But it's, since the levels are so short and bite-sized, they don't really overstay their welcome. They know just the right amount to place in front of you. I like it. I like it a lot.
The only thing that I would say that I don't like is you realize that the level... I mean, this is, I guess you could say this is true for any game, but the levels are just texture swaps, right? Because I mentioned it's hallways and blocks. So the first level is you have city streets. The second level is you're on rooftops. The third level is you're in like a Japanese type garden. You're like a Boro clan's homeland, and it's all the same thing. It's the same rooms. It's the same square platforms. They're just swapping out textures. Now it's gardens and trees. That as a kid, I remember. Like I've already said it a few times. After I beat it as a kid, made me feel like the game was inferior to Devil May Cry, because Devil May Cry had, in my opinion, just as cool action. And just a cool story, but better environments, more in, like the castle had all these secrets in it. And I don't know if that, you know, you brought it. I didn't know it was originally a Dreamcast game, which also makes a little bit more sense, because as you were talking, I read this game dev thread on the scarf. This is either using a fake camera particle system or an actual model way. Otherwise, the scarf looks way too smooth for the PS2 era, which might explain why the environments are very empty, since the scarf wouldn't be playing with Havoc's physics performance, because Havoc was really the only physics engine in use during the PS2 time. So maybe that combined with originally it was a Dreamcast game, which they would have had even more hardware limitations. Because I believe the PS2 had a slight edge over the Dreamcast in terms of power.
Yeah, it did. It was more powerful than the Dreamcast, which, once again, it's I feel like that's Sega's like console legacy, is after the Genesis, all of their consoles were too advanced for the time they came out. And so because they were too advanced, the prices were up, and there's a whole number of things. There's a whole... litany of reasons why Sega got out of the console game, and it just, the Dreamcast just sucks because it was such a great console.
Such a great console.
And it just came out at the wrong time. And it wasn't even like it was a bad price point. It came out a couple months before the juggernaut of the PlayStation 2, and nothing was stopping that.
I believe it was you that turned me on to Retronauts.
Yes.
So their episode on the Sega Saturn was the shit. That is one of the coolest podcasts I've ever listened to. And similar to what you were saying, it was actually the PS1 episode, and they ended up talking about the Sega Saturn because Sega was like, okay, this PlayStation thing is happening, these 3D graphics. But the Kaz Hirai, whatever, the guy that had been championing the PlayStation and pushing Sony, and that's his own podcast episode. He had spent years trying to make this work after the failed partnership with Nintendo. Sega was playing catch-up, and they needed to create a console. According to Retronauts, they needed to play catch-up and create something as powerful as the PS1, but they only had like 9 or 11 months. The engineers had like 11 months to design it, and they did it. But it was kind of like a pod racer, like Anakin, like putting shit parts together. Yeah, the way they explained it is they had like different CPUs and different coolers, which made the Sega Saturn way more expensive to produce at a mass scale. And so they couldn't compete, like you said, on price point.
And they also, I'll be quick because we do have to talk. Since this doesn't relate to Shinobi, but they also released the Sega 32X in North America, which was a 32-bit add-on to the Sega Genesis. And it came out less than a year to the Sega Saturn, which they bumped up the Sega Saturn release date to begin with. So that way they could, I don't think it beat the PS1 to market. I think that was the idea behind it because they were trying to, I don't know, actually. I'd have to, now I'm curious. Sega Saturn, let me look it up real quick.
I had a 32X, by the way. I was one of the rare people that had a 32X.
I won a 32X real bad, actually. I didn't delete Sega, so I just searched Sega PlayStation. So PlayStation 1 came out in North America on September 9th, 1995, and the Sega Saturn came out on May 11th, 1995. So it was slated for the fall of 95, and they announced it like it wasn't E3, but it was like E3, but
yes,
basically
yes.
It was an expo. And they are just like, you can buy it today. And all the developers were even like, what the fuck? Like, none of our games are ready yet. You promised us an extra 4 months to work on these. And now you're releasing this 4 months early. So it's like,
it was doomed.
They kind of screwed themselves over with it. But anyway.
That relates to Shinobi in the sense of it was originally a Dreamcast game combined with the Scarf technology, which it seems like there's this whole thread of developers on Reddit and NeoGAF talking about. I think I was right, like that might have been one of the earliest sort of physics based cloth animations, and that would have been really restrictive if the game was originally developed with lower technical specifications for the Dreamcast. It came out on the PS2 early. The PS2 was new. That might explain my biggest gripe with it, which is the environments being so barren and repetitive.
And that would make sense. Yeah, because it was designed for a lesser console. And when they added in that Scarf thing, it also eats up a lot of processing power of the PS2 to
do
that.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts on Shinobi for the PS2? Is there anything else that we didn't talk about that you wanted to dive into? Because we've covered everything that I wanted to. But is there anything else that you wanted to talk about that we just didn't talk about yet?
Yes, very much so.
Okay.
The music.
Oh, okay. Go for it. What do you got?
Basically, it hits what came to my mind this week. It hits to me. This might be saying a lot. It might be overhyping the music.
Bah.
But I like it. It hits me the same way Streets of Rage 2 hits me, where it's like shitty techno music that's so shitty it's good. Like I can listen to it. It's kind of like upbeat. I don't know who composed the music. I don't know if you did any research on that, but it's like, and maybe I'm drawing straws to try to connect it to other Sega titles. I don't even know if the music composer is related to who worked on Streets of Rage in any way, shape, or form. but it channeled what I liked about the Streets of Rage series was the soundtrack, specifically in Streets of Rage 2, was my favorite, one of my favorite soundtracks of all time. The first four levels that I got through this week, each level has one song, like one main theme for that level, and I liked all of the songs quite a bit.
There's six composers for this game.
Oh, geez.
Yasuhiro Kawakami, Teruhiko Nakagawa, Tatsuyuki Maeda, Fumi Kumatani, Yutaka Minobe, Masaru Setsumaru. So those are the six on there. I apologize if I butchered those. It was very Americanized, but I did my best. Yeah, there's a lot of composers that worked on this game. It might have been just like, because there is a thing where it's like, if you look at like some old games, a lot of times the composing credits are credited to a team. They'll say like the Falcom team or the such and such team. Like it'll be like a developer and then the such and such team. So it could have just been, this could have just been a Sega team, and now we actually know all the different people who worked on it, but it could have just been a team of composers that, you know, Sega just puts on all of their projects or something. Yes. Like that, and they all contribute in some way.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true. It felt like a Sega soundtrack this week when I was
hoping I would see Yuzo Koshiro on here, because that would make sense then, because he did the music for Streets of Rage. I think he did anyway. I want to make sure now. Hold on.
Yeah, let's look that up.
Yeah, he did Streets of Rage. He did the Streets of Rage soundtracks. So that's what he's most famous for. And I just want to be 100% certain. I'm looking at his stuff right now, trying to see what year Streets of Rage. Yeah, Streets of Rage 1, 2, and 3 he did the music for. And so he didn't work on it, but it's funny cuz I didn't play a lot of Streets of Rage like at all until somewhat recently. I streamed it about a month ago or so, and that's when I played it really for the first time. And I already heard the music was good for the series, but I didn't really, you know, I never really sought it out to listen to it. It's pretty damn good. I was pleasantly surprised by it, because every time I would hear it outside of the game, I was like, this is not bad. It's pretty good. And then I heard it in the game, and for some reason, it just like, it clicked on a different level.
Yeah, it's, I don't listen to the Streets of Rage music in the car ever, but it's like video game regular music that you listen to while driving or walking or working or whatever. That's a different, there's a different goal for that music versus video game music. Video game music's in the background. It's supposed to give you a vibe and kind of maybe flesh out the world and the environment. But it's also, like you mentioned before, it's made to be listened to over and over and over and over and over again. Because you're going to play that same, it's attached to a level. There's something about when hearing that music actually while playing the game, that's where the magic comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Just pulling up the Streets of Rage soundtrack outside of nostalgia feelings on Spotify, it's not going to be my first choice. But for some reason, and that's how I feel about the Shinobi soundtrack. I would never listen to those songs outside of playing Shinobi. But for some reason, while playing the game, I was like, damn, this song slaps. Like, it fits. Like, it works.
There's something about old game music like that. I mean, not all of it's great, but, you know, it's definitely, I don't know. I like it. There's just something about it, and it just, certain songs are timeless that I could listen to outside of the game they're intended for, but a lot of it is very much built around the experience of the game. But anyway, anything else to talk about with Shinobi before we do our wrap up?
I would say it's, if you like action games and you like ninjas, it's still worth playing. It's not great, but if you can snag a copy of it, if you have an emulator and you want to try it, I certainly overall in prepping for this podcast had fun playing the game. It's still fun.
That sounds like an endorsement to me, especially because you were pretty fair with your your criticisms of it. So the fact that you still had fun despite the limitations and the issues that you called out before, I actually want to find a copy of it. One, just because I like how it looks. I think this game looks cool.
Yes, I
think it really does.
It still has style that like just aesthetically and the way it looks and it feels, I mean, the feeling gameplay is actually pretty not the best, but yeah, it's got style, man. And maybe I'm a sucker for aesthetics. Like they still go a long way for me, even though some people would argue it's surface deep and game. I do think gameplay is more important overall, but what we were mentioning before earlier, like if you don't love the character, I don't, it's like, there's, like, say, Horizon, for example. Horizon is a great open-world game. I didn't love Aloy's character design. And I almost didn't beat that game because I just kind of got over playing as her. Like, I after 15, really? 20 hours, I was like, eh, I'd rather be a cyborg ninja. Like, I wish...
see, I didn't have that. I thought Aloy was awesome. I loved that character.
I liked her hair. But her badass her red braids were dope.
I also just like that. I think the only part of that game that I didn't like in terms of character design was young Aloy. I thought she looked like an alien.
It's true. She looked weird.
She looked so creepy to me. And then once, you know, once she became an adult, then I'm like, okay, this looks like a human again. Like it was just so weird. 'Cause none of the other kids looked like aliens. It was just her. I don't know what was up with that. I think it was just like the hair looked like it was a wig. I don't know. I love that game though. That is one of my favorite games. But that's interesting that you got tired of like her design, because I thought all the different
the armors help.
Types of armor she would get. I just thought it was just badass.
Yeah, the armors definitely help. And the reason I brought that up is Shinobi. At least playing it in modern times this last week, after, you know, experiencing all sorts of modern games, was sort of an inverse of that. The gameplay is tolerable at best, especially the controls and the camera. But I still think the aesthetics and the look are so cool that I find the game. I still like. I'm probably gonna go back and beat it, even though we've already recorded the podcast. Like I'm far enough through it, I'm enjoying it enough. I might as well just go beat it. Maybe get some more clips for videos or whatever. It's good enough that I'm planning on beating it even after the podcast is over.
There you go. That's a ringing endorsement if I've ever heard one. So that wraps it up for this episode of Still Loading. Cade, thank you for joining me on this episode. This was really fun.
Yeah, thank you. Anytime, man. Anytime.
Where can the good people find you online? You have your podcast, the Gaming Memories Podcast, but where do you want people to find you or your podcast online?
Gaming-memories.com is the website URL. You can find links to all the socials from there. It's generally Gaming Memories Pod, P-O-D, on any social platform. There are a lot of other Gaming Memories. I didn't think about that when I made the name. And on YouTube, if you find it's... really hard to find me on YouTube. I get comments every day like, I can't find you on YouTube. I don't know what the secret is. You're going to have to go to my website and click the YouTube link, because when you search Gaming Memories Pod or podcast, it does not come up on YouTube. I don't know why. But everywhere else, if you type in Gaming Memories Pod, it's going to show up on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, etc.
All right. And then as usual, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Still Loading Podcast on all of them. If you want to reach out to me, you can contact me, stillloadingcontact@gmail.com. You can support the show in a couple of ways. The easiest way would be to give a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcasting app you use. That helps get the show out. It helps people find the show. If you want to support monetarily, you can check out my Patreon, patreon.com/stillloadingpod. Even just $1 a month will help grow the show. Check out the Podbeard Network, the network I'm a part of. You can go to podbeardnetwork.com and check out all the great shows on there. And finally, the most important shout-out/pug is the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of children receiving inpatient care at hospitals. If you want to check it out, go to bitbybitfoundation.org and consider donating. And with all of that said, that is all I have for you this week. Cade, thank you once again for joining me.
No problem. It was a blast.
And I will see you all next time.
Bye-bye.